Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Even the Bush administration hasn't been able to get its numbers straight on this one. Just how much is the surging demand for biofuels adding to the cost of our food? Last month, the agriculture secretary guessed maybe 2 or 3%. Then a USDA economist said the food price impact is more like 10%. Now, a leaked report from the World Bank essentially says not even close. Wait till you hear how much it figures biofuels are raising prices. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation. Online at kauffman.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Thanks for spending part of your holiday with us on this firecracker of the 4th of July. There's going to be a common theme running through the program today: energy independence. Is that idea even realistic? We've tried growing our own energy lately, burning corn and other crops for fuel, and now we're seeing food prices climb. The Bush administration says it's a small price to pay, but there's word the cost has been way understated. A report leaked from the World Bank now blames 75% of price rises for wheat and other cereals on biofuel production. Britain's Guardian newspaper broke the story today, and Marketplace's Stephen Beard has details from London.
The leaked report was prepared by a senior economist at the World Bank. In effect, it claims that 75% of the jump in food prices was caused by Western governments. The US and Europe encourage farmers to switch away from growing crops for food and into biofuel production. That, the report says, led to a sharp decline in cereal stocks. That triggered a wave of financial speculation, and that pushed up food prices. Robert Bailey is with the aid agency Oxfam.
Poor people in the developing world typically spend 50-80% of their income on food. So something that drives the price of food up 75% is absolutely catastrophic for a poor household.
The leaked report contradicts Bush administration claims that biofuels account for less than 3% of the rise in food prices. The administration says higher demand from India and China is mainly to blame. The report also refutes this. And, says Aditya Chakraborty of the Guardian newspaper, that may explain why the World Bank didn't publish it.
One source said to me, this report, were it to be published by the World Bank, would put the World Bank in a political hotspot with the White House. Because after all, President George Bush has been a great enthusiast for biofuels.
The bank denies that it suppressed the report. It says it was only an internal discussion paper. But now it's out, and campaigners will use it to call for a moratorium on the use of biofuels. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
U.S. financial markets were closed today. Other markets around the globe were not. Even so, the relentless rise in oil prices seemed to take something of a holiday, dropping below $145 a barrel. Encouraging news for as long as it lasts. We'll look at trading around the world when we do the numbers. For years now, rich and famous Massachusetts residents have been opposing plans to erect 130 wind turbines offshore. They complain it would spoil the view off Cape Cod. This week, the state's congressional delegation urged the federal government to approve a test project that would use floating wind turbines. They'd be positioned nearly 50 miles off the coast and effectively out of sight. At the opposite end of the country, there are hopes for turning the ocean itself into a power source. But even those plans have encountered some choppy seas. Elizabeth Wynne Johnson has our story.
If there's a symbol of the ocean's raw power, it's the crashing wave. Oregon State University electrical engineering professor Annette Von Juan is working on ways to capture the water's potential.
As soon as the waves start to crest, we start to lose that energy.
Von Schwan runs the nation's top wave energy research lab.
Our goal is to harness the energy in the heaving ocean swells.
How it works? Giant offshore buoys capture the ocean's unrelenting force to generate electricity. The churning water has what Von Schwan calls energy density, meaning that a little bit of ocean can produce a lot of electricity, enough to impress Oregon Congresswoman Darlene Hooley.
The potential is there to produce about 10% of the energy needs of this country.
The Democratic representative sponsored a bill to put $250 million into wave energy.
It means jobs, it's research and development, it means new investments into the coastal communities.
The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission already has a dozen permit applications for projects, including wave energy parks with arrays of buoys that connect to the grid by cables on the ocean floor. Suddenly, the open ocean starts to look a bit more restricted.
I'm all for new and innovative ways of getting energy, but I'm almost certain that anywhere that they do this will be another closed area for us.
Kevin Dunn of Astoria, Oregon, is a commercial fisherman. He's worried that fishermen won't be able to drag their nets through those new wave energy parks.
There's places that it might be absolutely wonderful, and there are places that we may really, really, really not want them. And given the history, chances are they're going to be right where we don't want them.
The pursuit of alternative and renewable energy is a kind of modern-day gold rush. Everyone's staking claims. Depending on how you look at it, the ocean's half full or half empty. I'm Elizabeth Wynn Johnson for Marketplace.
A little later in the program, we'll be talking to an author who's been trashing the idea of energy independence. He says it's just not realistically possible. But some of the innovators looking to free us from our oil habits are promoting an invention that could turn one man's trash into another's energy source. At the same time, they suggest their idea could help clean up the mess we're making of the planet. From our innovations desk at North Carolina Public Radio, Janet Babin reports.
This new trash technology is based on something as old as the sky. Not the thunder, but the lightning that goes with it. And in this case, the lightning is contained inside our reaction chamber, and the bolt never ends. This man-made lightning is so hot, most things put inside the chamber completely vaporize in seconds. The technology is called plasma gasification, and proponents say it could be the answer to our growing trash problem. Although it uses intense heat, developers insist it's not incineration. The Not In My Backyard crowd has complained for years about emissions from burning trash.
It's a non-combustion process. The waste is not burned. It's converted.
That's Dan Cohn of MIT. He was part of a team that developed a plasma gasification device for a company called Integrated Environmental Technologies. IET says its plasma melter can take a ton of trash down to 5 cubic feet in less than a minute. To see how it worked, I took some of my own trash, an old sneaker, and headed up to Richland, Washington, where IET demos its plasma melter. The stainless steel chamber where the lightning happens is about 5 feet long by 3.5 feet wide. Before the sneaker can go inside the chamber, it has to be shredded. So IET's president Jeff Surma and four engineers take a bandsaw to it.
Andy looks like he's having fun here.
Yeah.
How many engineers does it take to shred a sneaker? Now for the fireworks. Surma picks up the play-by-play.
It's going into the plasma zone. So first, the shoe gets processed, pre-processed in the gasifier, and then what doesn't get completely gasified there drops into the high-temperature plasma zone.
That plasma is about the temperature of the sun. Most of the sneaker is vaporized in seconds. The rest comes out looking like a blackish glass bead. IET says beads like this can be used as fill in road construction. Since it was mostly plastic, the sneaker also created about 4 gallons of a gas that could be used to make alternative fuel. Jeff Surma says rising energy prices have more firms interested in his invention. But plasma melters are still rare in the U.S. Dr. Robert Doe with the Salina Group says that's because the new technology threatens two powerful industries.
You know, we would be taking away large business for the landfill people and the incinerators. So waste companies do not want to see this technology come out. On the other hand, if we produce power, we'll be infringing and disrupting the coal business and fossil fuel burning business.
Critics say plasma technology uses too much energy and is too expensive. And Steve Bolton with McDonough Brongard Design Chemistry says the technology could send the message that trash is okay, kind of the opposite of reduce, reuse, recycle.
We see waste as a signal of design failure because products and materials can ideally be designed so that they can maintain their flows within closed loops.
In other words, products that can be recycled into items with second and even third lives. But transforming all consumer goods into products like that is a long way off. In the interim, plasma gasification might be the best way to shrink our growing trash problem with technology as elemental as lightning. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Of course, Janet mentioned the idea that it's okay to trash the planet is not exactly something to be encouraged, even if we could zap our garbage into thin air, and especially if all that you're left with in the end is thin air. For commentator Juliet Shore, it's the sheer volume of what we're consuming that's creating such a big problem.
Global consumerism devours resources like there's no tomorrow. And unless we address how much we consume, we won't succeed in averting disastrous climate change. Consider this. Per capita GDP has more than doubled since scientists first identified rising temperatures and ecological limits back in the 1970s. Now, technological fixes have to deliver twice the environmental benefits just to keep pace. They aren't. For example, more fuel-efficient cars are offset by more vehicles on the road and more miles driven. Gains in residential energy efficiency have been wiped out by bigger houses and more power-hungry appliances. This volume problem besets other parts of the consumer economy, too. Plummeting prices at stores such as Walmart and IKEA have caused a buying explosion in clothes, furniture, appliances, and consumer electronics. How big an explosion? Per capita, we're purchasing almost twice as many clothes as we did in 1991. The volume of furniture, measured in pounds, has more than doubled in just 7 years. In fact, households are buying almost everything at rates far higher than a decade ago, from food to glassware to sporting goods. And all those products put carbon in the atmosphere as they are produced, shipped, used, and discarded. Counting on technology to overcome the surge in what industrial ecologists call material throughput requires magical thinking. It may go over well in economics textbooks, but falters in the real world. So let's not kid ourselves. We can only become sustainable by tackling the incessant growth in consumption that drives our economy. That'll require green taxes, smarter regulation, and new, less supersized lifestyles.
Juliet Shore is a professor of sociology at Boston College. She's also a founder of the group New American Dream. Your thoughts? Just click on the contact link at marketplace.org. Time to check the week on Wall Street with stockbroker and business analyst David Johnson, who is joining us today from the Sunshine State, huh?
Yeah, you're darn right. WFSU in Tallahassee, Florida, just right out the window here is that big stadium where they go, ooh,
So you have to go out looking for sunshine because you can't find it on Wall Street these days, right?
Yeah, well, sometimes you have to hide. Sometimes you have to hide. Now, it was a short week on Wall Street. I guess it was reasonably predictable. We weren't looking for anything too great. But we may have actually dodged a couple of bullets this week.
Well, we certainly didn't dodge the fact that we are now in officially bear market territory.
Yeah, I don't think you need that headline. I could have told you it was a bear market a good long while ago, because my definition of a bear market's different from the 20% mark that I guess is a conventional. It turns into a bear market to me when every rally in the market is seen as a selling opportunity, because in a bull market, it's just the obvious. Every time the thing goes down, everybody says, oh, boy, they're having a sale. Let's rush in and buy some stuff. This is really just the opposite. This has been a bear market for a long time, but there's a real dilemma here, Bob. And if you're a long-term investor, the danger now is probably greater being out and missing on that bounce than being in.
Well, you talk about it being a selling opportunity all the time now. It looked to me like everybody unloaded what they wanted to on Wednesday, and then they got out of town.
Yeah. Really what was left. I mean, a lot of this stuff is pretty well sold out, I think. And now we're just sort of going along story by story by story. There was a story early this week that I thought was really spooky. This guy, Jonathan Carl, who's really a crackerjack reporter. He used to be with CNN. He's with ABC now. And he did this very credible-sounding story that said a senior official in Israel said, we're getting ready to go after Iran. And then the market, you know, started looking at that and said, my gosh, you know, oil's bad enough right now. You have this disruption in flow. Then you have another war to deal with. You know, the fact that we could recover to whatever degree we did after that, I think was a plus.
Well, we don't see any end in sight to these rising oil prices. And the market seems to respond every time in just the opposite direction.
Yeah, I know. Absolutely. They are still in lockstep. And the only thing we can suggest is that at some point it will. I think the long-term trend for oil is pretty clear. We don't have any of this stuff, and it's got to go up in value. But I think the market is beginning to look a little bit more, you know, at the economy. And you can't confuse the economy with the stock market. Just because we see bad economic numbers coming out right now does not necessarily mean that the market goes down. I mean, the market usually will rally. And if there's a turnaround in the market, it usually happens during bad economic times because the market's looking ahead 6 months.
But yesterday as a rally was really thin.
Yeah, it was. I mean, they bought some blue chips back. You know, the employment numbers were not great, but they weren't bad. I think now there's a little more worry about being short going into a long weekend and something good happening than being long and something bad happening.
Well, at least we've all got some time to think about it now. We've got a few down days here.
Now, wait, let's not call them down days. We've got a couple of holidays.
Okay, thank
Happy
you.
Happy 4th of July, Bob.
David Johnson joining us today from the studios at WFSU in Tallahassee. Coming up, fixing up two wheels so the four-wheeling gas guzzlers can stay home.
Tightening the chain, actually, what I'm doing now. Well, maintained bicycles shouldn't make any noise.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street took a vacation today, but there wasn't a whole lot of celebrating this short holiday week. The Dow dropped 0.5% to close at 11,288 for the week. The Nasdaq shed 3% to finish at 2245. The S&P 500 was down since Monday 1.2% at 1262. Things turned south again on world markets today. European stocks dropped 1.2%. Asian markets were mixed, but the Nikkei was the big loser, down another 0.2% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Clarkson Potter's The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat. Available now. Whether you're busy or lounging around, the economic gears are always turning. Marketplace is available around the clock, too, as a podcast. Get your financial fix whenever you want it. Download the show and take it with you. Just head over to our website at marketplace.org and click on podcasts.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Monday. Leaders from the Group of Eight Nations gather in Japan to discuss energy and security issues. The yearly bull run in Pamplona, Spain begins. As many as 3,500 runners will be chased by bulls over the half-mile cobblestone course. And on this day in 1930, construction began on the Boulder Dam, now known as the Hoover Dam. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdahl. Baseball, hot dogs, apple pie, red, white, and blue fireworks, all things that identify us as Americans on this 4th of July. Maybe we could add one more. How about our quest for energy independence? That's something we've been talking about for a long time, but is it really an attainable goal? Robert Bryce is a freelance journalist who specializes in energy issues and the author of Gusher of Lies, The Dangerous Delusions of Energy Independence. Mr. Bryce, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here, Bob.
This Independence Day, we're talking about an idea that's been floating around for quite a while in American politics and policy, that we need to be independent from foreign oil.
It's pretty clear right from the title of your book where you stand on that notion, but this has been around for a long time. Where and when did this idea come from?
Well, it originated in the Nixon administration. Richard Nixon gave a speech in early 1974 in which he declared that the U.S. would be energy independent by 1980. Obviously, we know that didn't happen. Gerald Ford promised it. Jimmy Carter promised it. We've heard about it from essentially every American president since Nixon. But now, in the wake of 9/11, we've heard these renewed calls for energy independence, and it's no more possible today than it was in Nixon's time.
Well, it's understandable why this idea is so appealing, though.
Well, sure. And as I say in my book, I think there are four factors that create or contribute to what I think is kind of a free-floating anxiety in America about energy issues. And it's the second Iraq War, global warming, peak oil, and terrorism. What these advocates for energy independence have done in recent times is conflate the issue of oil and terrorism and created this argument that, oh, if only we use less foreign oil, then all would be better. But it's simply not true.
What do you think people interpret this to mean when they talk about energy independence?
Well, that's hard to say. I can't answer you directly. I know that this issue polls well. When they poll likely voters, this issue of energy independence is the one issue that gives people hope. It gives them hope that somehow there's a way forward in dealing with these apparently intractable issues.
Well, I think to many people, energy independence can help drive innovation. And as Americans, we have a strong can-do identity, being independent in all regards. Why do you think this idea is so dangerous?
Look, I just recalculated these numbers last night to look at the size of the global energy sector. The world uses about 80 billion barrels of oil equivalent per year. That means that the global energy sector on an annual basis is worth over $7 trillion. The idea that the U.S., the world's single biggest energy consumer, can be independent of the world's single biggest business is ludicrous on its face.
I'm reminded of that movie title from a while back, No Way Out. Is that the case?
Well, look, there are ways forward in terms of the U.S. energy consumption. I'm a big advocate and believer in natural gas vehicles. The U.S. imports 60% of its oil. It only imports 20% of its natural gas. We could make better use of our domestically produced natural gas in the terrestrial transportation sector. I think that the market is already moving toward non-oil alternatives. We're seeing growing interest in electric cars. But we're only going to quit using oil when we come up with something that's cheaper, cleaner, more convenient, or all of the above.
If energy independence is a myth, then what language should we be using for what it is we're trying to accomplish here?
I think it should clearly be energy interdependence. We accept our interdependence in other markets, whether it's fresh flowers or iPods or the cell phones that we use. We are interdependent in so many other commodities. So I don't understand why politicians feel this need to single out energy as an area where we should be independent. It makes no sense. So I think we need to move beyond this myth that we can be self-sufficient when it comes to the single most important commodity in the economy.
Well, happy Interdependence Day then. Robert Bryce is the author of Gusher of Lies, The Dangerous Delusions of Energy Independence. Thanks for your views.
Thank you.
Okay, so maybe it's not possible to achieve full energy independence as a nation. But consider one city in Europe where most people have declared their personal independence from gas-guzzling automobiles. It's a place where most journeys begin with 2 feet and 2 pedals. Amsterdam. 740,000 people live there, and they own 600,000 bikes. On this installment from our series, A Day in the Work Life, we meet a guy who helps keep them rolling.
Tightening the chain, actually, what I'm doing now.
Well, maintained bicycles shouldn't make any noise. Almost nothing. My name is Wim. I'm a bicycle mechanic and I'm the owner of this shop. I got involved in the bicycle business because I owned one of these big three-wheel bikes with a box that you use here for transporting. I always did the maintenance on that one myself, and so I wanted to know more about it. Actually, there is a school here in Amsterdam for bicycle mechanics. It's a 2-year education. I got my exam, and I'm also a teacher. The most typical problem with bicycles in Amsterdam, well, Bicycles need to be parked outside because the houses here are very small and there is no storage inside. And that means that the bicycles endure a lot from the weather conditions, and I think that's basically most things that we do is cables that rust, bikes that fall over and something is bent, flat tires, an accident. That's also one of the typical things from Amsterdam. Here we have streetcars and they ride over a rail which is embedded in the middle of the streets, and if you get caught with your front wheel in these rails, your wheel suddenly makes a move in a direction you're not suspecting, and then you just trip over your handlebars and then you're face down on the street, and that can be very, very painful. Most of the times the people themselves are not hurt so badly, because otherwise they wouldn't be here, but in some cases the bike is completely ruined. A day it can be as less as 10 bicycles that I repair. On a busy day it can be up to 35-40 bikes that I have to repair on one day. Standard repairs are done within 10-15 minutes, so then you can do quite a lot in a day. But respoking a wheel will cost you about half an hour. Restoring old bikes, you can be working on one bicycle a whole day. I used to work 3 days a week, and that paid me about 1,500 euros every month, about $2,000. And at the moment, this is my own shop, so if I need some cash, I just grab it. Generally, between $20,000 and $30,000 a year. Why are bikes such an important way of transport in Amsterdam? Well, it's because the way the city is designed. It's quite a small city. I actually call it the largest village in Europe. In half an hour, you're from downtown to the outskirts of Amsterdam. It's the fastest way, it's the cheapest way. You have no parking problems. Everywhere there are racks where you can park your bicycle. And it keeps you fit, of course. And it's just, it's fun. I have absolutely no interest in cars. I don't even have a driver's license. I don't need one. Perfect.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Rico Galliano.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note for all of you hitting the road this holiday weekend, gas prices are probably making you groan. Wouldn't it be nice if you could have locked in a lower price for gas months ago? There's a company set up to do just that. MyGallons.com just launched a service where you can purchase gas at a set price and, it claims, say goodbye to price hikes. Problem is, the Los Angeles Times reports the company hasn't passed muster with the Better Business Bureau. The Bureau gave MyGallons.com an F rating. And as the spokesperson said, it's just like school, so an F is obviously bad. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. The markets were closed today for the 4th of July holiday. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Coming up Monday, GM lets shoppers cruise for new dates along with new cars in the Motor City.
Actually, the cars are like ultra sexy. I want to take this one home. I don't know if they let me drive off with it, but if they will, I'll take it.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you're having a bang-up holiday.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.